Today is Monday, July 10th. We're going to work on finishing up the digestive system today. We're on page 90. Or did we get 89?
88.
88, okay. 90 sounds a little far, doesn't it? Okay. So let me recap where we've been so far. I know it's been a while since we talked about the digestive system, but before break, we talked about the mouth, pharynx, esophagus, and stomach. What we want to do is keep track of what's happening in each location. So let's take starches, for instance. Where do we begin starch digestion?
Mouth.
Good. Do you remember the name of the enzyme? Amylase. Good. And of course, that breaks starches into simple sugars like monosaccharides. Okay. We've also talked about proteins. Where did protein hydrolysis begin?
Stomach.
Good. Can you tell me two enzymes that contribute to protein hydrolysis? Pepsin and? Renin, yeah. So those two can help to break down proteins. So when we're talking about breakdown, I want to emphasize that the breakdown process is hydrolysis that takes polymers and breaks them into what?
Monomers,
good. So when we get to the small intestine, this is the last stop for hydrolysis. This is where we finish the breakdown of all of our food groups, and this is where we do the absorption process as well. This is it. Okay, so small intestine does hydrolysis of all food groups, and this is where we absorb those nutrients into the bloodstream. So if you get beyond the small intestine and make your way to the large intestine, all we're doing there is dehydrating the feces, pulling water into the bloodstream, and making vitamins. So this is it. This is the last stop for getting those nutrients into the bloodstream. So the structure here is basically all about breaking down those food groups, and it's about absorbing those nutrients into the bloodstream. So let's talk about the regions of your small intestine. Where the small intestine hooks up to your stomach is an area that we call the duodenum or duodenum. Okay, that's the first several inches of your small intestine. What is the next major region? Jejunum. And the last portion?
Ileum.
Good. Now, inside, we have a number of modifications that maximize surface area. This organ is all about breaking down the food groups and absorbing the nutrients into the bloodstream. So these modifications here are all about maximizing surface area. You're going to have more of these modifications toward the duodenum end, less of them toward the ileum end. So as you get towards the large intestine, you're going to actually start to get less and less of these modifications. So how would you describe a villus? Finger-like projection. Good. So it's the lining of the small intestine that is modified into finger-like projections. That helps us to maximize surface area. The goal for us here is to absorb nutrients into the bloodstream. So let me tie this in for you. When we talk about the small intestine lining, each villus has a set of capillaries running up in there, as well as a set of lacteals. So back when we covered the lymphatic system, what was the job of that system? Good. Picking up extra fluid. So in fact, that's what these tiny lymphatic capillaries do. They pick up fluids from the intestinal tract. And they're called lacteals because of the color of the fluid. What does lac as a prefix tell you? White or milk, okay? And so it's not necessarily milk that's being picked up, it's actually white colored fluids. In fact, they are fatty fluids that are being picked up by those lacteals. These capillaries, however, that pick up food and nutrients are gonna take you to venules, to veins, and eventually that food is going to go to the liver, and the liver is going to filter out and remove some items. So we are now in the process of picking up those nutrients through the lining of this small intestine. These are called villi. Each one of these finger-like projections is a singular villus. You'll notice there's cracks and caves in between those things, and that's a great place for enzymes to hang out. So these enzymes are going to be called brush border enzymes. It is their job to break down foods that are in this area. I kind of think this looks like the surface of your tongue. Okay, so they in fact call this fuzzy looking surface a brush border surface because of all these hills and valleys created by those villi. Now, what we can't see from this particular view is a set of microvilli. And these are yet another set of extensions on each individual villus. I've had people tell me these look like little Christmas trees. Okay, and you can see each villus has all of its own individual hills and valleys. Those are yet again to help us increase what?
Surface area,
good. And maximize absorption. Yeah, this is the place where you absorb all your nutrients. Okay, so pretty cool looking picture here. You've got a villus sticking out here and here and all around. But what they're doing is they're situated in a big mountain and in the valley. These are called the circular folds or plicae circulaire that are inside our small intestines. What purpose do they serve?
Slow you down.
Slow you down, yep. So they're speed bumps, so to speak. When food is traveling through your small intestine, it's going to spend around 3 to 6 hours here. We need all the help we can get in slowing down those nutrients. So these speed bumps or circular folds make sure that food doesn't travel through too fast. So in summary, we've got three things that help us to maximize absorption: finger-like villi, teeny tiny finger-like microvilli, and then circular folds. All are going to help us maximize absorption and increase surface area over which we can do that process. Okay, didn't have these in the stomach, right? Okay, we have these to some extent in the small, in the large intestine, but this is the main place where we see all this nutrient absorption. Okay, down near the bottom of your page, let's summarize the jobs of your small intestine. So we've got a lot of grinding to do here. In fact, peristalsis is something we expect. How would you describe peristalsis? Movement, yes. Squeeze it, move it along to the next portion of your intestine. But yet there's a special type of movement that occurs here called segmentation. We describe segmentation as a washing machine effect. It moves the food a little bit forward, and then it moves the food a little bit backward. So if you think about waves that hit up against a wall and reverberate backward, that's kind of how these segmentation waves work. What is the purpose of doing this in the small intestine? Yeah, absorb more food and mix it with? Yeah, with that food coming from the stomach. Yeah, that's right. So enzymes, we're going to help mix it up, prepare it for absorption. So it's just like a washing machine. It breaks down this food into smaller particles and prepares it for absorption. Okay, so the very last thing down here, numbers 2 and 3, chemical digestion of all food groups occurs here. That means proteins, carbs, nucleic acids, and lipids are all absorbed here in the small intestine. We do break them down using enzymes, and the enzymes come somewhat from your small intestine and also from your pancreas. So it's kind of like a tag team effect of getting these enzymes into the small intestine. Let me mention fats for just a moment because they're a special group. We have not yet mentioned any fat hydrolysis so far in our story. You do a little bit of fat hydrolysis in your mouth, but it's not really enough to consider part of the big picture. In your small intestine, though, that's where we really ramp it up and start to break down those fats. So what is bile contributing to fat digestion? Breaking it down, good. And there's a fancy word for it. Do you see it there?
Emulsify.
Yeah, emulsify, good. So what is emulsification?
Breaking it down,
yeah. So if you've ever seen the commercials on TV for Dawn dishwashing liquid, they always advertise that Dawn breaks up the grease. They show you a sink full of nasty, greasy dishes, and they drop in Dawn, and these nasty grease particles separate and float away. It makes you think, boy, this stuff is magic. I've got to buy me some of that, right? So that's what bile does. It takes big globs of fat, and it breaks them into smaller, more manageable pieces. So it's not necessarily hydrolyzing fat into its building blocks or monomers. All we're doing is making big globs into smaller, more manageable globs. It's kind of a gross thought, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you don't have bile, what happens to all that fat? It goes right through you. It comes right on out the other end. And I know this is a nasty thought, but if you turn around and check out what you've left in the toilet, the stuff that floats is full of fat. If there's not a lot of fat in the food that's in the feces, then it sinks. But if you have consistently, I know how nasty, right? If you consistently have floating feces, then that means that the bile or the lipase is not adequately breaking down that that fat. So backtrack it. What organ produces bile? You sure? Liver. And who stores it? There you go. So now we say, okay, if you have constantly fatty feces, then look back at the liver and gallbladder and see if they're producing adequate levels of bile. Liver, of course, produces it. Gallbladder dehydrates and stores it. So poop can tell you something about your health, right? Another thing about bile, what color is it? I know you've probably vomited something that looks greeny yellow, right? Okay, that's bile. That yellowish green color is bile. This is awful to be talking about after lunch, right? See, if you pulled up that yellowish green stuff, then the vomit is coming from the small intestine. Well, normally bile should be excreted and go out with your feces. And in the process of leaving with your feces, it should degrade to a brown pigment. So when you see brown feces, that says, hey, I'm producing bile. It's being used to emulsify those fats. Now, if you have pale-colored feces, that means the bile was not being released into the feces. And people who have clay-colored stools, I'm talking the color of these walls, then that indicates, once again, a liver or a gallbladder issue. So color of feces and whether feces float or sink are all indicators for liver and gallbladder health. It could be that the bile is not being... If it's something on occasion, it's probably what's been eaten, or maybe the bile isn't adequately broken down, but if it's consistent, then that may be something else to look at. Maybe whatever's in the diet or what supplements somebody may be taking. Yeah. Interesting.
Sooner or later. My daughter takes them in the middle of the week, a couple weeks ago. I was like, is this normal? And I was like, this happened to me before.
It's probably just
one time, so I was wondering how you can do it with the bile.
It's probably just, like you say, a one-off event based on what you've had.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of grape did rain to turn to rain.
Grape?
It will.
Interesting.
I know, it's interesting. But it will.
That's interesting that purple will turn.
Yeah. It does.
Checking out her
poop? Yeah, I freaked out when that little purple.
My daughter drinks Gatorade. I have to ask her to take a look.
She drinks a lot of grapes.
She does. She likes that in the blue one.
There you go.
Yeah. Science experiment at home.
There you go.
I had a dog and a crayon. We got all colors.
Ooh, I bet you did. I bet that made constipation. Oh, yeah. Not Skittles, but. That had to be,
Yeah, that was
nasty. Okay, so I think we're down at the bottom of that page. How about questions on 90? Oh, I'm sorry, 88. I'm still stuck on 90. Okay, how about let's turn to 88 and we'll talk there more about what we're doing with all these nutrients. Okay, so all these food groups that we're breaking down, including fats, are going to be absorbed into the villi. Each villi has a capillary inside that's going to absorb the nutrients. And once we're in the bloodstream, we can now travel with these nutrients. First stop is ultimately going to be the liver. So let's take each food group one by one, starting off with your carbohydrate group. We know that carbohydrate digestion begins in your mouth using salivary amylase. So amylase is an enzyme that helps to hydrolyze or break down starches into simple sugars. The stomach contributes chemical, or rather actual physical digestion of those carbs. There isn't really any chemical digestion in the stomach for carbohydrates. Once you get to the small intestine, though, we're going to break down these sugars into their building blocks. Let's take pancreatic amylase. What specifically does that hydrolyze? Starches, yeah. So that breaks down starches. Guess what maltase hydrolyzes? Maltose, good. And sucrase? Sucrose, good. And the last one, lactase? Lactose. So if you're lactose intolerant, you don't have?
Lactase.
There you go, lactase, yeah. So each one of these carbs has an enzyme specifically built to break it down. And notice that these enzymes mostly come from the pancreas. So the pancreas contributes enzymes to help break down or hydrolyze these food groups in the small intestine. This is the end of the road for the carbs. Once we hydrolyze them, they are then absorbed into your small intestine's villi, into the bloodstream, and now that blood can be distributed throughout the body. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs a slide. So let's talk about proteins. We know that we chew proteins in our mouth, but they actually aren't hydrolyzed until we get to the stomach. When we mean hydrolysis, we mean that we're breaking down polymers of proteins into their building blocks. What is the building block? Amino acids, good. So in the stomach, we have pepsin. Pepsin helps to hydrolyze or break down proteins into amino acids. What pH environment is necessary for that to happen? Acidic. Good. Renin is a special protein or an enzyme. It helps to break down milk proteins, and so we've got a specific one just for milk protein digestion. Once we travel into the small intestine, we finish the job of hydrolyzing or breaking down our proteins. Notice the syn endings. Pepsin in the stomach, trypsin, and chymotrypsin in the small intestine. So the syn endings are the ones that help to hydrolyze or break down proteins into amino acids. Okay. So from our small intestine, we absorb our nutrients, these amino acids, into our bloodstream, and from there they can be distributed to the body. Let's talk lipids one more time. We know that there's a tiny bit of lipase in the mouth. It does a very small amount of hydrolysis of fats. But where we really get payback for all this fat digestion is in the small intestine. So in the small intestine, we have bile coming from the liver and the gallbladder. It's an emulsifier, meaning it does what?
Breaks them down,
right. Big globs into smaller, more manageable globs. Along comes lipase, an enzyme. That is the one specifically able to hydrolyze the fats into their building blocks. So let me emphasize, this is a tag team effort. You've got to have the bile to make big globs of fat more manageable. And then lipase comes along and actually hydrolyzes the fatty molecules into their building blocks. You really need both of these to get the job done in order to absorb fatty acids and glycerols into your bloodstream. If you have one without the other, you don't get complete fat hydrolysis and absorption into the bloodstream. So think of bile and lipase as, you know, a buddy effect. They've got a tag team effort here in order to break down those fats into their manageable building blocks. We also have nucleic acids that we want to pay some attention to. We oftentimes don't talk about these at all because, you know, who eats corn for its DNA? Or who eats, you know, a steak for the DNA of a cow? We don't really think about that as being a necessary nutrient, but we do take the nucleic acids in animal and plant and fungi products, and we break them down using nucleases. Those are enzymes that break apart the nucleic acids. And then we turn around and reassemble them into our own nucleic acids. So the old saying that goes, you are what you eat. Yeah, no joke, because we actually borrow nucleotides from all these products that we eat and reassemble them into our own DNA, RNA, or even ATP. Finally, we have a couple of vitamins here to look at. A, D, E, and K, or ADEC, are fat-soluble vitamins. We do absorb these in the small and even to some extent in the large intestine. So out of those, we actually can make D in the skin and exposure to sunlight, and we can make vitamin B and K, Burger King, right, in the large intestine. I do want to mention that the B and C vitamins are water-soluble. For the most part, we can't store those. Okay, but we can store the fat-soluble vitamins in our fatty tissues and in the liver. So looking at these two groups of vitamins, which one should you take with food?
The fat-soluble.
The fat-soluble, yeah. And of course, you need the fats in the food to help you maximize absorption. Which ones are okay to take with just a glass of water? The B and the C, right, the water-solubles. So if you're taking a whole multivitamin that has everything in it, and you take it on an empty stomach with a cup of water, you're not getting as much as you possibly could of the fat solubles because they need food to maximize absorption. So A, D, E, and K are going to be ones that absorb through fatty molecules into the body. All right, how about questions on the small intestine's job so far? So a couple more things for the small intestine. It is also a major site for absorption of electrolytes. When people have vomiting or diarrhea, we can actually take the electrolytes in the small intestine, we can pull them out through vomiting, or likewise, if a person has diarrhea, they can be flushed out the other end with the diarrhea. So if we happen to lose these electrolytes before they're absorbed into our bloodstream, we're losing things like iron and calcium, we're losing things like sodium and potassium. So we're going to affect those electrolytes presence in our bloodstream if we happen to lose them prior to. So you'll notice things like iron and calcium are only absorbed if we need them in our small intestine. Thinking back to the hormone chapter, which hormone increases blood calcium levels? Yeah, PTH, good. Yep, that increases blood calcium. It can cause your small intestine to absorb more calcium. Why do you need iron? Yeah, hemoglobin, blood cells, exactly, good. Interesting to note that sodium reabsorption or absorption here is coupled with glucose absorption, and we take in potassium through our small intestine as well. So just something to think about here. Back when we talked about blood pressure and osmotic pressure, we know that osmotic pressure is based upon the amount of electrolytes we have in the bloodstream. So let's take a person who's had vomiting or diarrhea. How does that influence osmotic pressure? You can't reabsorb, yeah. So your electrolyte levels will be decreased. You can't reabsorb fluids from your interstitial space. Therefore, what happens to your interstitial space? Swells, yeah. So this is yet one more reason why we need the electrolytes. It's not just for nerve and muscle physiology. It's also to maintain pressure and pull those fluids back in the bloodstream. So that's why electrolyte balance is critical, especially during something like a GI upset. Water is, of course, something we do absorb somewhat in the small intestine, also in the large intestine. And I just wanted to show you this. This is about 10 liters of fluid a day that are just from secretions that we reabsorb back into the bloodstream. You know, if you add it all up, there's a couple of liters of fluid just by the time you get to your stomach, your pancreas, bile. All of that contributes to the amount of fluids that are secreted into your digestive tract and ultimately reabsorbed. I thought this is interesting to note that out of all of these secretions in your digestive tract and all the water that you drink, only 1% of those fluids end up in our feces. So we are pretty efficient at pulling fluids out of whatever we eat and drink. You know, a lot of that stuff is going to be pulled into the bloodstream. Maybe you get rid of it by your urinary system, but very little is actually lost in your feces. So, you know, we're drying machines. We suck the water out of everything we drink. Okay, so that should take you down about midway of the page. How about questions on the small intestine? Take-home message. What is the main function of your small intestine?
Absorption.
Good. So absorb those nutrients, get them into the bloodstream. Good. So this is a no-brainer, right? The large intestine is large because?
It's large.
It's large. Is it length large or is it diameter large?
Diameter.
Diameter, yeah. The small intestine is around 20 feet in a cadaver. That's really long if you were to lay it out. And a large intestine, the cadaver, is about 5 feet in length. And so to scrunch it together, we actually have a couple of things here that help to shorten it up in a living person, and that comes from the muscle tone associated with your longitudinal muscles. So what is this band of muscle around the large intestine called? Tania coli, good. And it makes these puckers called?
Hostra,
yeah. So, of course, we've got 5 feet that we need to shorten up to fit in our abdomens. So, yeah, it is a larger diameter, but in fact a shorter intestine. So at what point does the small and large intestine join? What is the name of that sphincter?
Ileocecal.
Good. So you can't see it from this picture, but it's on the right-hand side. And, of course, that joins the ileum of your small intestine to what portion of your large?
The cecum.
The cecum, good. So the purpose of that sphincter, like any valve, is to prevent
backflow.
Okay, so now what is in the large intestine is destined to become feces. We do not want feces backing up through the ileocecal sphincter into the small intestine. Why not? You don't want to absorb feces, right? Okay, and what feces contain are some bad stuff, like some bacteria that can cause some major infections like E. coli. So, yeah, leave that ileocecal valve shut unless food or feces are passing through to the large intestine. There's actually three main regions here. The cecum is the first. We have the colon, and then we have the rectum. I think this picture is funny because it just kind of disappears there at the rectum like that's the end, but there, in fact, is something else beyond the rectum. What is it?
Anus.
Anus, yes. So technically, they're not considering it in this picture part of the large intestine. We know that's the terminal portion of your digestive tract. So let's take the cecum. It's on the right-hand side of your abdominal pelvic cavity. It has a blind pouch housed there called the appendix. What is the function of the appendix? They say there's not a real function for it, but we know that it's a lymphatic tissue. And what does lymphatic tissue do for us? Clean, yeah. So we think that it has a role in cleaning stuff, and as we know, it can become infected and it can rupture. But it actually is made somewhat like the other parts of your digestive tract. This picture, I think I had one. No, I apparently took it out. It's got the four same layers as the rest of your GI tract, so it apparently is just a cleaning area, nothing more than we can figure at this point. So as we travel from the cecum up the right-hand side, we travel into the ascending colon. We make a right-hand turn at what? Hepatic flexure, good. Travel across the transverse colon, which sits around where your navel is located, and we make a left-hand turn at what flexure? Splenic, good. Come down the descending colon, make another S-shaped curve at?
Sigmoid,
good. And then we straighten out here for the rectum, and of course from that point down, we now then encounter the anus. Okay, so let me take you to the top of page 91 and talk to you about the anal canal for just a moment. The anal canal is structured so that we can expedite the release of feces. So you'll notice inside what we have are called anal columns, and these columns are running vertically so that we can help expedite feces toward the exit. There's also anal valves in here. These right here and right here are considered anal valves, and you'll notice they kind of point upward into the rectum. That's to prevent the passage of solid matter when gas is being released from the rectum. So sometimes, of course, those can fail, but the job is to keep the solids in. Down here at the actual opening, we actually have two sets of muscle tissue. There's an internal involuntary sphincter. It is made up of smooth muscle. That is the one that you, of course, don't have control over. And the external sphincter on the outside is made up of voluntary skeletal muscle. That is the one you do have control over. So during the defecation process, we have an opening of the internal sphincter when pressure is in the rectum and the anus. And so the opening of the internal sphincter then causes us to make a decision. Either we open the external sphincters at that point or we force and keep them closed. Sometimes the pressure is so great that you cannot keep the external sphincters closed, and that's when accidents happen, right? So the externals are the ones that you should have conscious control over. It does take good nervous system control to keep the external shut. For most kids, it's around ages 2 or 3 or even older before they can consciously keep that external sphincter closed. Nervous system accidents like strokes can also interfere with your conscious control. And so later in life, if people have, say, problems with their spinal cord, then again, they can't keep that external sphincter closed. So that is the one that we do have voluntary conscious control over. Okay, so how about questions on the parts of the large intestine?
Which one do we have voluntary conscious control?
It's the external sphincter. And I wanted to show you, these are not very pretty villi. They're not like the small intestines villi. These, in fact, are starting to lose their character. So you do have some villi as you enter the small or large intestine, but the job here is for water and vitamin absorption. As you approach the terminal end of the large intestine, we see a decrease in villi. Therefore, that tells us we have less and less ability to do what? Absorb, yeah. So these are going to disappear by the time you reach the anus. You can see there's pretty much stratified squamous in that area, not really built for any absorption at that point. So the absorption in your large intestine is limited to a couple of things. Water, vitamins, but not nutrients. Where do we accomplish nutrient absorption?
Small
intestine, good. What are the vitamins made by your large intestine? Vitamin B and vitamin K, exactly. And I should be specific, it is vitamin B12, because that one is needed to make blood cells. Yeah, so intrinsic factor, you're right, comes from the stomach, and then we need B12 to help come into the bloodstream to make new red blood cells. All right, so thinking about vitamin K is needed for blood clotting. And I want you to think big picture here. If you take antibiotics and you kill the bacteria that make these vitamins, B12 and K, how would that influence blood clotting? Decrease it, yeah. So if somebody's on a long-term course of antibiotics, you may notice things like bruising, right? Or difficulty with blood clotting easily. So yeah, that's something we kind of have to think big picture about, is how does an antibiotic affect these bacteria and their jobs of making vitamins? We know that feces production is another job here. What does feces contain besides undigested food waste? Water, mucus, bacteria, right? Even dead epithelial cells that are covering the inside lining of your digestive tract. So what we're looking at here is stuff that you couldn't break down and get the nutrients from. And of course, defecation is the process of removing these undigested food waste and all the extras like mucus and bacteria from your digestive tract. So let's talk about how we get a defecation process in motion. There's three kinds of movements that will contribute to defecation, and they're listed next as hostral contractions, mass movements, and then, of course, the defecation reflex. Okay. So when you're looking at the large intestine, you'll notice these puckers here created by the Tinea coli. Those puckers are called hostra. Those hostra can contract about every 30 minutes, and the goal is to push feces to the next hostra. Okay. So on your worksheet there, the function of a hostral contraction is to push feces to the next hostra. Push feces to the next hostra. So that's not going to produce a bowel movement if all you do is every 30 minutes push feces right next door. You know, if you're talking about 5 feet of intestines, that's a long time getting to the end, right? So we need something else to help us out with a defecation reflex, And that is the second item listed there. It's called a mass movement. So mass movements occur 3 to 4 times per day. Normally, your rectum is empty. Unless you're having a mass movement, you do have the opportunity to fill your rectum with feces. So what are some things that might be occurring in your life that could produce a mass movement? What might you be doing early in the morning, around noon, around 6 or 7?
Eating,
yeah. Going somewhere dirty. So yeah, when you eat, of course, that produces a mass movement. And what happens there?
Pushing
food to the rectum. Yep, so the mass movement, this is the way to go if you want to have feces propelled to the rectum. The mass movement pushes feces toward the rectum. So mass movements push feces toward the rectum. Some things help to stimulate a mass movement, such as coffee or warm liquids. Fibrous foods can stimulate a mass movement. Just simply eating a big meal can make your stomach stretch. That induces a mass movement. You may know someone, including yourself, that has a mass movement after a meal, and it may be the same time every day. So mass movements are something that are kind of routine for the large intestine to get used to. You know, we're very routine driven, so if you're eating at the same time every day, then expect a mass movement to follow. So what we're doing here is we're getting feces into the rectum. Only then do you actually have an urge to have a bowel movement. Normally when the rectum is empty, you don't have the urge to go. But when you fill the rectum stretches, and that's going to excite a set of splanchnic nerves, which are sitting down here in the lower portion of your spinal cord, to send a message to your brain. So this is classic parasympathetic control. It's the cranial nerves and the sacral nerves that are working. So only under parasympathetic control can we initiate a bowel movement. So what does that tell you about stress and constipation? They go hand in hand, right? What system is activated during stress?
Sympathetic.
Yes, sympathetic. So that overrides parasympathetic control and makes it more difficult for this to happen. So these mass movements are going to then include, or induce rather, a defecation reflex. And like we talked earlier, that's going to open up that external anal sphincter that you voluntarily control and allow for you to force a bowel movement. Okay. I should mention to you that the large intestines are finicky. You know, if we open somebody up and do surgery, those large intestines may take up to a week to get back to their normal routine, and they even have a medication that can help to induce the movement of them again. What would be the trouble of giving somebody something to eat if their large intestine motility had come to a stop? Can't go to the bathroom, yeah. So it locks up their bowels, they can't produce a bowel movement, and now they're going to be constipated or impacted from all that food in the large intestine. So yeah, they listen with stethoscope, listen for bowel sounds to make sure that there's some type of motility there. Otherwise, you know, we don't want to feed somebody until the large intestine is back to its normal routine. Down near the bottom of your page, I do want to mention a couple of issues. Diarrhea down there, constipation, has to do with how mobile your large intestine is. Some things can cause great irritation to the lining of your large intestine and increase motility. That can lead to diarrhea. If motility is decreased and you hang on to the feces for longer than normal, that can lead to extensive drying out of the feces and constipation. This is the reason you don't want to push when you have a bowel movement. I'm going to cut the lights for a minute so you can see. So these are diverticulum. They're little out pockets or blowouts on the large intestine wall. And that's something. Look at all those cavities there. And normally this may not cause any problems unless they get irritated and infected. Over here on the right, you can see this one is covered with pus. So that is diverticulitis. That is an actual infection of that diverticulum. And of course, that would be very painful since there's now an infection in those out pockets. So what are some foods that would irritate these little out pockets?
Beans.
Yeah, seeds, grains, yeah, things like rice. So anything small and hard like a seed or a grain would be trapped in those areas and can lead to inflammation and infection in those areas. These are not diamond rings. These are cuts through diverticulum, and that is feces trapped in each one of those. You can see all of these out pockets here are diverticulum, and no, there's nothing you can do once they form. They're yours to keep. So the rule of thumb here is if you can avoid pushing really hard to have a bowel movement, then that can minimize the amount of diverticulum that we form over a lifetime. Here's another reason not to push really hard during a bowel movement. The hemorrhoids seen in this picture are actually failed valves and veins. So they are, in fact, varicose veins. So what you're looking at is an internal hemorrhoid inside the anus, and then what's visible from the outside is an external hemorrhoid. And these are varying degrees of hemorrhoids. So yeah, they can bleed every time a bowel movement is produced. You have to wait for those vessels to heal if it is possible. All right, so that should do it for that page, and then I think we're ready for pancreas next. Do you all want to break now, or do you want to wait a few minutes? Doesn't matter. This is a good place to pause. Why don't we take about a 5 or so minute break, come back about, say, 5 minutes of two, and we'll pick back up here with pancreas then. Okay, so we've actually finished the trip through the digestive tract. What we're going to do now is focus on some accessory organs and what they contribute to the process of digestion. We've actually taken care of the teeth and salivary glands and tongue, so we're going to focus instead right now on the pancreas, the liver, and the gallbladder. So first, let's hit the pancreas. We know it is a triangular-shaped gland that sits behind the small intestine. It is somewhat retroperitoneal, and it is actually behind the peritoneum. So as a way of review, what is the peritoneum? Good. Good. Holds the intestines together, wraps and covers on the outside, and of course the mesentery is part of that peritoneum. So when we're calling the pancreas retroperitoneal, we assume it's sitting behind that layer or membrane covering. The pancreas is actually both an endocrine and an exocrine gland. Back when we covered hormones in the endocrine system, we did not talk about things like a bile duct or main pancreatic duct. Instead, back then, we were talking about specific cells called islet cells. You may recall they made two types of hormones called what? Good. Insulin and glucagon. Good. So by the way, that's a blank there on your sheet for you. Pancreatic islet cells make insulin and glucagon. Since our focus right now is on the digestive system, we're going to focus on how the pancreas works as an exocrine gland, and the secretions made by your pancreas ultimately get dumped into your small intestine, and then they get carried to the exit of the body through the feces. So we're going to look at this main pancreatic duct. We're also going to focus on this bile duct, which actually brings in fluids from the liver and gallbladder. And I'm sure you've seen this accessory pancreatic duct from lab as well. So the specialized cells for the digestive system in the pancreas are called Acini cells. These particular cells don't make insulin and glucagon. Instead, they make digestive enzymes and fluids that are bicarbonate rich. So we're going to focus on those two fluids for just a moment. Let's take the alkaline bicarbonate ions first. Thinking big picture, what is the pH of the fluids coming from your stomach into your small intestine? Acidic, good. And of course, your blood pH is not an acid. What is your blood pH? Base, yeah, about 7.35 to 7.45. So what happens to your blood pH if you all of a sudden absorb a pH of 1 into your bloodstream? Drops it, yeah, makes it very acidic. And so then we have this yo-yo effect that we really want to avoid. That gets us out of our homeostatic range. So the pancreas releases these alkaline or basic bicarbonate ions. Those ions have one big job, and that is to neutralize the stomach acid before it gets absorbed into your bloodstream. So what we do is we bring the pH of your stomach secretions up closer to 7.4, and what we're absorbing now is going to be more isotonic in terms of pH value with your stomach secretions and your blood pH, rather. Let's see, I had a couple of questions down there on the very bottom of your page for you. Okay, so very bottom there, number two. Why is it important for chyme to be the same pH as your blood? Well, to maintain blood pH, we're looking at around 7.4 overall as being your blood pH. Okay, so it's important to bring that stomach acid up closer to 7.4 so we can be approximately the same as blood pH. So now let's turn our attention to the enzyme-rich fluids coming from the pancreas. These enzymes are going to travel through a pancreatic duct here, either the main or the accessory. They're going to be dumped into your small intestine where they hydrolyze or break down all the food groups. So let's take them one by one. What does pancreatic amylase help us break down?
Starch
into sugars. Good. Okay, so that first blank there, pancreatic amylase helps you break down starch into sugars. Pancreatic lipase helps us break down fats into their building blocks. They are? Good. Fatty acids and glycerol. And hey, here's our sin words again. Trypsin and chymotrypsin, they break down what?
Proteins.
Good. Proteins into amino acids. So to summarize, we've actually got two different kinds of fluids coming from your pancreas. We have a bicarbonate-rich fluid. That helps us to bring the stomach secretions closer to our blood pH. We don't want to upset our blood pH because it's going to be a basic value around 7.4. Those enzyme-rich juices coming from the pancreas are dumped into your small intestine. That helps us hydrolyze and break down all those food groups and ready them for absorption. So let's think big picture here. How does the pancreas know it's time to dump secretions into the small intestine? How does your pancreas know there's food present? That's going to take us over to the top of page 93. Okay, so let's talk about secretin and CCK. Okay, first thing to notice, both secretin and CCK are made by the small intestine. Yeah, made by the duodenum of your small intestine. The small intestine basically rings a bell and says, hey, I've got food here. Send me your secretions to help break down the food. So the small intestine is the one that signals that there's food ready and that it's time to secrete the products, whether they're enzymes or bicarb fluids, into the small intestine. So we know the story with hormones. How do all hormones travel?
Blood.
Good. Let's take secretin first. What two target organs are going to be hit by secretin?
Pancreas and liver.
Pancreas and the liver, good. So what does the pancreas release?
Bicarbonate-rich
juices, good. That comes, of course, from the pancreas back down the main or accessory duct. It is released through that hepatopancreatic ampulla into the small intestine, and it's there that we start to neutralize that acid chyme more to a neutral 7.4 pH. At the same time, secretin targets your liver. Your liver makes and releases what?
Bile.
Good. What is the function of bile? Yeah, emulsify fats, take those big globs, break them into smaller, more manageable globs. So the bile that is produced by your liver comes by way of these hepatic ducts, down the common hepatic to the common bile, joins with the main pancreatic duct, and the bile is then ejected into the small intestine. Some of that bile may also be backed up into your gallbladder and stored there for later use. But nonetheless, once it's placed into the small intestine, it emulsifies fats, and then it leaves with the feces. Okay, so notice what will trigger secretin. It's not just any old food. What specific type of food? Acid. Okay, check that out. Secretin is released by your duodenum in response to acid-rich foods. Let's talk about cholecystokinin, or CCK for short. Let's break the word down. What is col as a prefix?
Bile.
Good. And what is a cyst?
Yes.
Bladder. Yeah. And kinin means to
move.
Yeah. So you've got bile, bladder, move. It all tells you what it's going to do. We can call it CCK for short. And in fact, the gallbladder is one of the target organs of CCK. Notice again, where is CCK made?
Small intestine.
Small intestine, right? This time in response to what type of food? Fats and proteins, good. Like all hormones, CCK travels through the bloodstream and it targets the gallbladder and the pancreas. The gallbladder's only function in life is to dehydrate and store bile. So, of course, the gallbladder ejects that bile back through that cystic duct, down the common bile, and through the hepatopancreatic ampulla into the small intestine. So what kinds of fluids is the pancreas going to release?
Enzyme-rich,
good. And so those enzymes travel the main pancreatic duct, once again through the ampulla, and into the small intestine. What do those pancreatic enzymes do for our foods? Break them down. Yep, finish the breakdown process. Get that stuff ready for absorption. Okay, so we've got two hormones, CCK and secretin. Both are made where?
Small
intestine, good. Both will target the pancreas. Which one specifically targets the liver?
Secretin.
And of course, CCK targets the gallbladder. Okay, so keep in mind there's different foods that will trigger each one of them, and the goal is to release a slightly different fluid from your pancreas. Ultimately, we're going to get both bile and juices into the small intestine simultaneously to help break down those food groups. How about questions there on CCK and secretin? If you'd like a layout of this in just a different format, I've got them on this PowerPoint. You're welcome to grab these. This is our digestive system 3 PowerPoint slide. Okay, so I've got one for secretin and one for CCK. Y'all ready for the next one? Here's the next one. Anybody still need? Y'all good? Okay. So let's talk about the liver for a few minutes, because it's a very varied organ. It has a lot of different jobs. First of all, in terms of anatomy, it's located on the right side of your abdominopelvic cavity. It sits up underneath the diaphragm. It is, in fact, our largest digestive organ, and this is a neat fact. It can regenerate if enough healthy tissue is left intact. What you're looking at from this angle is the anterior or ventral view. There is a left lobe that is smaller over here and a much bigger right lobe. And of course, we can turn it around on the backside and see the caudate and lobe and the quadrate lobe above that. So just another interesting tidbit, this falciform ligament that divides the left and right lobes is actually a remnant of your umbilical cord. So your umbilical artery and veins that come into the body through the belly button actually travel through this area, and then they link up with their respective IVC or aorta. And upon birth, of course, that umbilical cord is clipped, the umbilicus heals after a few days, and no longer are we nourished with oxygenated blood from mom through that passageway. But what is interesting is what's left behind. This falciform ligament is actually a remnant of those blood vessels. So kind of a cool history behind that ligament. All right, and you can also see a little green sac there. We know that is the gallbladder. In which lobe is it located? On the right lobe, good. Okay, so let's talk about hepatic portal circulation for just a moment. Instead of just memorizing or just reading this list to you, let me walk you through what happens to get blood to the liver in the first place. The story starts back with the small intestine. The small intestine is the site for absorption of nutrients. In the inner portion of each villus, there is a capillary, and that capillary is going to pick up nutrients from the small intestine. Well, we know that capillaries take blood to venules. What do venules take blood to?
Veins.
Good. And of course, in this view, there's a lot of veins picking up blood from the intestines, both small and large. There's two major veins that we're going to focus on. One is called the superior mesenteric vein. The other is called an inferior mesenteric vein. These are picking up blood from the intestines, and they are, in fact, woven into the mesentery, or that visceral peritoneum that covers our digestive organs. So down here is the inferior mesenteric coming up this way, and up top here is the superior mesenteric. And ultimately, they're going to come together with splenic veins, and they join and come here toward the hepatic portal vein. So I just picked the superior mesenteric vein as a starting point for us from this vein pathway. We will follow it to the hepatic portal vein. So on those lab models, you probably saw a little blue stump and called that hepatic portal vein. This is a bypass venous network that takes blood through the liver before we get back to the heart. So normally, where do most veins dump their blood? IVC or SVC, yeah. So notice these veins aren't actually dumping blood there yet. These superior and inferior mesenteric veins take you to a hepatic portal vein before we ever make our way back to the IVC. Okay, I didn't hear that. It was capillaries.
Yeah,
see,
I'm
old, Leo. Sorry. Okay, so let's go into the liver now, because you've got to be able to see the insides to understand what happens next. This is a branch of your hepatic portal vein right there. And you'll notice these look like pages of a book that are rotating around the spine. So over here in the very center is called the central vein. That makes sense, right? The central vein's in the center. This is another way to look at it. This is the central vein in the center. And each corner here has a hepatic portal vein branch. Let me go back, because every one of these little branches has hepatocytes lining the passageway. Those hepatocytes are picking up fluids from the blood that's traveling through. If insulin is present, guess what you store in those hepatocytes? Glucose, yeah, as glycogen, yeah. So if you've got insulin present, you break down, of course, you store glucose as glycogen. If glucagon is present, then you may be releasing sugars into the bloodstream. These hepatocytes may also store heavy metals. Things like lead or arsenic may be stored there, but unfortunately, heavy metals can't be excreted, so they are ours to keep for the lifetime. That's how a person can get heavy metal poisoning. Those hepatocytes are like sponges. They'll take and they'll store that stuff in their cells. I just want to point out that going in the opposite direction from the central vein over here toward this bile capillary is actually the production of bile. And it's running countercurrent or opposite to the direction that blood is flowing through this hepatocyte. Okay, so let's back up. We started the story by picking up blood, nutrient-rich, from our capillaries. We joined the venules, we ended up in the superior or inferior mesenteric vein, and we traveled then to the hepatic portal vein. From the hepatic portal vein, we traveled through these sinusoids that are lined with hepatocytes. Into what vein are we dumped next?
Central vein.
Central vein, good. So there we are, central vein, okay? Then, of course, this central vein is in the middle of this ring of cells that you see here. And there's lots of central veins. I don't want to give you the impression there's just one central vein in the middle. There's one central vein in the middle of this setup, but there's hundreds of those sitting throughout your liver. All right, so all of those central veins eventually take us to, hepatic veins. There they are, okay? And hepatic veins take you to IVC. Yep, and then you know the story, right? From IVC, we go to the right atrium, and you know the blood flow from there. So all this is a detour or a bypass through the liver. It gives the liver an opportunity to filter out and remove items and store them there for later use. In fact, you'll store glycogen there for about 3 days. After that, your liver says, I'm tired of holding this for you. Turn it into fat. Yep, so turn it into fat. So that's about how this is going to work in terms of using the liver as a temporary storage device. One more time, or do you feel okay with hepatic portal? One more time, sure. Okay, so I'm going to start the story with your small intestine. We have villi with capillaries inside. Those capillaries pick up nutrients. Those nutrients are going to flow from the capillary into a venule. And we're going to pick on the superior mesenteric vein. It picks up nutrients from the small intestine. Of course, now this flows along towards your hepatic portal vein. This is the vein that flows into the liver. Once inside, we're going to branch that hepatic portal vein through sinusoids. Those sinusoids are made up of hepatocytes. Those hepatocytes can then remove nutrients or even poisonous items like toxins or waste products and store them there. Ultimately, we're heading toward a central vein in the middle of this setup, and many of these central veins are going to dump us into an exit route called the hepatic veins. What do the hepatic veins dump us into?
Inferior
vena cava. Good. And of course, then we're back to blood flow going to the heart. Let me mention, since we're on the topic, that if people have colon cancer is a silent killer because people oftentimes have no symptoms from colon cancer. The colon cancer cells can break free. They can hop in one of these veins here. Those veins carry the blood up here to the hepatic portal and into the liver. Now those cancer cells make a secondary home, and we say that that cancer has metastasized. So once in the liver, now we have a setup of liver cancer. And how does this person know they've got a problem?
The coloration in the eye.
Coloration, yep. Turn yellow. They may be itchy. They may have liver pain. They may have other issues like males may grow breasts. So there's all sorts of symptoms that come along with having, say, hepatitis or liver cancer. So that's how liver cancer can become, or sorry, how colon cancer can become liver cancer. Let me emphasize the hepatic portal vein is the one that comes into the liver. Hepatic veins are the ones that exit the liver. Okay? Hepatic portal vein takes you into the liver, and simply hepatic veins take you out of the liver. Portal vein takes you in, hepatic veins take you out. Any questions on hepatic portal circulation? Okay, just to hit a couple of other functions of the liver, of course we know this is where bile is produced. I do want to mention on your worksheet that bile is made up of a number of things, including a yellowish-green set of pigments. It is the bile salts, though, and phospholipids that are actually responsible for the emulsification of what?
Fats.
Fats, that's right. And then we have cholesterol and triglycerides, things like that are part of bile. Those also contribute to the contents of what that bile is going to make. On the top of your next page, we also know the liver is responsible for storing glucose. The liver can also store fat-soluble products, such as fat-soluble vitamins. The liver makes plasma proteins, such as albumin. That's important for helping to regulate blood osmotic pressure. The liver is also a detoxification center for alcohol and drugs. This is a heavyweight thought to consider. Anything you put in your mouth goes to your liver. Okay? So anything you put in your mouth and it makes its way to the small intestine ultimately is absorbed into your bloodstream, and your bloodstream goes straight to your liver first. So whether it is a over-the-counter medication like Advil, Tylenol, aspirin, or whether it's a more heavy-duty drug like Percocet, for instance, or a street drug, anything that's taken orally ends up going through your liver first. So yeah, that's how excess alcohol or drugs or medications can irritate and inflame the liver, because it's ultimately the site for detoxification of these items. So if it's a rather potent drug, or if it's one that's frequently taken, then the liver cells can become inflamed. Also, bilirubin is broken down here. I think the word has a hidden clue, doesn't it? Bile, right? So this is one of our bile pigments, and of course the liver helps break this down, and we'll follow the story of bilirubin either through our digestive tract or our urinary tract. We've got to see where it takes us.
That's jaundice.
Jaundice, exactly. Exactly right. So speaking of irritation or inflammation of the liver, let's talk about hepatitis for just a moment. So hepatitis is a catch-all term that simply means inflammation of the liver. It can be viral in nature. It can also be bacterial. If you travel overseas to certain countries, you may in fact get a parasite in your liver. Ooh. Alcohol, we know, can inflame the liver, so can poisons or medications. And then you can also have an autoimmune disorder, which can in turn make your own white blood cells attack the liver. You've probably seen the billboards around town for, if you're born between 1945 and 65, get tested, right? So they've recently discovered a way to eradicate hepatitis C from the body, or at least reduce the chances for further inflammation. So a lot of people may carry it and actually not even know they're walking around with that particular virus. Mm-hmm. Look at all the symptoms here of hepatitis. You know, jaundice is certainly one that pops into mind here. But general itching also comes from having liver inflammation. So you think about what the liver is doing. It's detoxifying, and if it itself is now inflamed, we may not have this ability to reabsorb fluids, and so we may start getting edema and inflammation in our own tissues. Other things that are come along with hepatitis include dark urine, so like Coca-Cola colored urine, that means that bile ends up in the urine, or pale clay colored stools, another warning sign that there's an issue with bile production and removal from the body. So I want to read you all of these slides. These are in the PowerPoint if you're interested. There's all sorts of ways that hepatitis can be spread, especially if it's viral in nature. I think it's interesting to note that in this state, food workers do not have to have any vaccinations against any of these viral hepatitises. Other states do. And every now and again, there's going to be somebody working in a restaurant kitchen that had exposure to a particular hepatitis virus, and then hundreds or more are now going to have to get tested or vaccines against that particular hepatitis. So yeah, it can really easily spread through a lot of our bodily fluids. So yeah, you can see feces, blood, other types of bodily fluids can also transmit these viruses. So this is all here for you in case you would like to read a little more about hepatitis. Another issue with the liver we know of is cirrhosis. What happens to the liver? Dries up and hardens, yeah. So it can only repair itself to a certain extent, but if there's an enormous amount of abuse to the liver, such as through medications or alcohol, then the tissues harden and it's unable to perform its job in storage. In this picture, you can see a normal liver on the left, a cirrhosis liver that's enlarged on the right, and in the middle, you actually get a look at a fatty liver. So what do you think can cause a fatty liver?
Alcohol.
Fatty food, some alcohol.
Sugar.
And extreme dieting. If you're eating along normal calories, 2,000 a day, and all of a sudden you cut it back to 300 calories for a couple of months, your liver says, guess what, we are dying, right? And so it starts storing fats there. So every time we talk about this, I think about the people on the Survivor game show, what abuse that does to your body. So, you know, if you don't win that $1 million, you could go home with a fatty liver disease. So yeah, extreme dieting, cutting calories massively can lead to something like fat storage there. I swear this has been colored by Photoshop, but you get the picture, right? Okay, so it looks like we're down to gallbladder as our last accessory organ. It is a piece of our body that we can live without, thankfully, because people do have trouble with the gallbladder. So its only function in life is to store and release what?
Bile.
Let me make the issue here. Bile is not made by your gallbladder. It's just stored here. So where do you make bile?
Liver.
Good. All right, and so we already talked about it's located in which lobe?
Right
lobe. Good. So under the direction of secretin, secretin tells your liver to make bile. When your liver makes bile, it travels down these hepatic ducts, and ultimately that bile can travel to the common hepatic duct, common bile, join here with the pancreatic duct, and then dump into the small intestine. But the blank on your worksheet is for the other pathway. Sometimes that bile may be coming down the hepatic ducts and now back up your cystic duct. That's your blank. Bile can be concentrated and dehydrated, and it can back up your cystic duct. So when we dehydrate it, we remove the water from the bile, and we store the bile salts and the cholesterol and the fats there in the gallbladder. Then CCK tells your gallbladder to contract. Your gallbladder then rehydrates that bile, and the bile then travels from the cystic duct down the common bile, joins with the main pancreatic duct, and here we are in the small intestine. Once there in the small intestine, what does that bile do for us? Breaks down fats, right? Emulsifies bigger globs into smaller, more manageable globs. Good. So I'm going to show you some pictures of gall problems. These are gallstones. And if they're sitting at the bottom of the sac like you see here, they may be causing no problems. Where they tend to cause problems is when your gallbladder is contracting under CCK, and now they're going to be spit out that cystic duct and perhaps down the common bile duct. So every time a person eats, that process of trying to eject that gallstone is going to take place. Thinking about this picture, the gallstone may get stuck in the cystic, it may get stuck in the common bile, or even worse, it may make its way down here to the ampulla and get stuck there. Why do you think that is the worst place for the stone to get lodged? Everything's backed up, yeah. So now, liver can't get bile out. gallbladder can't get bile out. And what does this do to the pancreas? Backs it up too. Yep, so the pancreas can't eject bicarbonate fluids or anything else like enzymes. So that is the worst place for it to get stuck, is down here in this area. That can cause pancreatitis as well as issues with your liver and gallbladder. So I did want to show you, whoops, where is it? This picture here, you can see how large some of those gallstones can get.
I've seen one that takes up the whole gallbladder.
Whoa. Did the person take it home as a...
No.
That'd be something to put on your shelf and say, look what I made. Wow.
Now, how is that made? Like, how do you get something?
When the bile backs up, it removes the water, and bile contains things like fats and salts, and the fats and the salts literally make a little salty stone. So that's what that is. And every time you make bile, it's going to harden and add to that. It gets bigger and bigger over time.
The only way to get rid of that is surgery.
Mm-hmm. And imagine the day before surgery. You know, we in the past, 20 or 30 years have just started doing it laparoscopically. You know, before that, they would make a huge cut and take it out. And imagine before that, you know, a couple hundred years ago, you just either lived with the pain or died from it. So imagine, that'd be pretty vicious with one of these stones.
What's even worse is if your intestines all the way through and it gets stuck in your small intestine.
Ooh, that'd be really bad. I wouldn't think about it. You'd think that the peristalsis would push it along. Mm-hmm. Wow, that must be massive then.
Because it creates blockage of the whole thing.
And I guess there's nothing they can do except
cut you open and
take it out. Wow. Mm-hmm. But guys, that is it for digestive system. Would you like to do metabolism or read that one at home? Read at home? Okay. That was pretty unanimous. What about questions for Wednesday? Any topics I can go back and hit to help you out? Latonya?
I'm having an issue with effects
of
compensation.
Okay. Of respiration. Okay, let's go back and hit that. Okay, this information is found on pages 74 and 75.
I just want to have them keep that straight.
Okay. Okay, so if I hyperventilate or if I hypoventilate, I'm changing three things. I'm changing pH of the blood, CO2 levels, and oxygen levels. Okay, and if I hyperventilate, I'm going to get rid of too much CO2, so my CO2 levels drop. My blood pH becomes more alkaline, so I've got alkalosis. And I'm hyperoxic, which means I've got too much oxygen in my bloodstream. Okay, that's cause and effect. So the faster I breathe, those are the three changes I expect in my bloodstream. If I hypoventilate, I'm going to have too much CO2. Blood pH becomes acidic. And I'm hypoxic, so I have too little oxygen in my bloodstream.
It's on the recording.
It's on the recording, yeah. So the thing to keep in mind is these are cause and effects. If I change my breathing rate, these are the effects I expect to see. So if I've got a problem, I compensate with the opposite breathing rate. Meaning, if I have hypercapnia, I should breathe faster. That's going in the opposite direction. Or if I have hypocapnia, I should breathe more slowly. So I'm going to do the opposite breathing rate to maintain my blood CO2 levels, pH or oxygen levels. So let's do another one. If I have acidosis, perhaps lactic acidosis from exercise, acidosis is not going to make me breathe slower. Acidosis is going to make me breathe
faster.
Yep. So you can think of them as problems, or you can think of them as a compensation effect, but the compensation is going to the opposite breathing rate. Does that kind of help?
Mm-hmm.
I know this is the toughest topic on this test. Let me give you a couple of examples and let you work them out for a moment. Let's say that we've got a person who is in metabolic alkalosis from having had too many Tums. So metabolic alkalosis means that their breathing rate should decrease. Go opposite. Okay, so if I'm in alkalosis, that's a cause of hyperventilation. It can be also caused by other things.
You say alkalosis.
Alkalosis.
Oh, not acid. Okay.
Right, yes, so compensate with the opposite respiration event. Okay. If I am in the mountains and I'm hypoxic, my respiration should
increase.
Yeah, go the opposite direction. Okay, so hyperventilate when you're in the mountains and need some oxygen in your bloodstream. If you are really excited, you recently won the lottery, and you're going to breathe yourself into a... You're hyperventilating too much, right? So you're losing too much CO2. So what should happen to your respiratory system to normalize your CO2? Hypoventilate. Yeah, bring it in the opposite direction. So there's an old saying for this acid-base balance stuff, and it's called ROME. Respiratory opposite, metabolic equal. And basically the game here is, whatever problem you've got, if you want to compensate for the problem, go to the opposite respiration. Okay, so that may help. This is kind of getting you into that acid-base balance stuff. Should we go over this again? Would you like more detail here, or is this something you're more or less okay?
Yes, go over what hyperventilation is. That's like whenever you exercise.
Hyperventilation would be in response to acidosis. So see, that's a problem that can be caused by other things besides your respiratory system, and you compensate for it by hyperventilating. You get rid of more CO2 and more hydrogen ions by increasing respiration. Kelly, did you want me to go back through any? Okay. More examples, would that help? Okay. Let's do one where a person has, say, ketoacidosis from diabetes, and ketoacidosis is going to send their blood pH too low with too many hydrogen ions. How can their respiratory system compensate? Hyperventilate, right, because what does hyperventilation do to all of those acids? Breathe them out, yeah, exhale them out, so it sends you in the opposite direction. One thing to keep straight in terms of pH issues, if you're in acidosis, you want your respiration rate to go opposite, go up. If you're in alkalosis, you want your respiration rate to go opposite, which is to decrease respiration. So that may also help you keep those two straight. Yeah, acidosis, breathe faster. Alkalosis, you'll breathe slower to bring it back down. Let's say that someone has oxygen being provided through the nasal cannula, and it's too much oxygen, so they are hyperoxic right now. What should happen to their respiration rate? Decrease it, yes. So if they're hyperoxic, we compensate by hypoventilation.
Everything's opposite. So it's hyperoxia, it's hypoventilation. It's hypoxia, it's hyper.
In terms of compensation, yes, backwards, yeah.
Okay.
Because these are cause and effect,
yeah.
But yeah, the compensation is the opposite.
That just clicked with me, apparently.
Okay, that's good.
That's good. Okay, point to the word so that I can see it. What you were saying.
Okay, if you put oxygen in the nose through the cannula, that's hyperoxia, that's too much. And keep in mind, what we're doing right now is compensating. So I'm going to compensate by the opposite breathing, which is to hypoventilate.
Okay.
So this slide is cause and effect, but you can take it a step further by saying, okay, hey, if I've got a problem, I can fix it with one of these two respiration rates. You can take it into compensation.
So on the test, will you have a word compensate?
I will say, I've got a problem. How do I fix it? How do I compensate for it? I'll give you some guidance so you know that I'm not just talking cause and effect.
Okay.
That's like essay-ish?
Yes, there is an essay. I'll give you a problem and ask you to step me through how the respiration rate change helps. Yep.
So will you say like the hyperventilating or like do you say there's something?
Right, like if I say I'm having ketoacidosis, and I'm going to fix this problem or compensate for it by...
Oh, hyper.
Yeah, this can be fixed by breathing faster.
Okay, acidosis.
Acidosis, yeah.
How hyperventilation would affect it? Your hyperventilating would make the inspiratory center fire more quickly.
To make the diaphragm contract more quickly. That's probably just about that one. It just depends on if it's causing alkalosis or not. It depends on the question of what
it's asking. How would hyperventilation affect the inspiratory center in order to restore the
If you're hyperventilating, most likely that will feed back to shut it down, so you'll decrease respiration in the What else can I help you with?
78,
sure. Oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. What you want to appreciate off of this is being able to read the chart. So first thing to make note of is there's three lines on here. There's a normal line in the middle. There is a right shift. And there's a left shift. And so you'll need to know what can promote a shift to the right versus a shift to the left. So things that can shift you to the right are acidosis. What else? Hypercapnia, okay, and increased body temperature.
So
okay.
You said acidosis.
Acidosis.
Hypercapnia.
Correct.
Which is the same thing as hyperventilation. Can you use that same chart?
I wouldn't substitute that term. It can confuse you.
Okay. So you shift to the right. Your hypercapnia?
Correct.
Increased body temperature.
Order. Acidosis.
That means more oxygen is increasing. So the red line is.
Because you'll need more oxygen to feed that CO2. To make it.
Right.
That's right.
But yeah.
Okay, so when you shift to the right, you decrease oxygen saturation as opposed to shifting to the left, which increases oxygen saturation. So what are some things that will shift this graph to the left? Low body temperature.
Alkalosis.
Alkalosis. And low CO2. That's it. Good. Low CO2. Shift right is hot. Increased body temperature. Acidosis. And increased CO2. And that will decrease oxygen saturation shifting to the right.
In the chart.
Increase O2 saturation shift to the right. Okay, so let's take a number like 60 millimeters mercury. That's our partial pressure of oxygen. At a normal body temperature, we're going to go up here to this blue line and across, and we're going to estimate that to be, what, around 90 perhaps, percent saturation. Let's say that we're now increasing body temperature. What impact does that have on our percent saturation? Shift to the right. So now we follow the red line, come across, and you've dropped down to around 80% saturation. What if you're at 60 millimeters mercury for partial pressure and you shift left because of a cold body temperature? Yeah, about 92. Yeah, so you actually increase percent saturation. So there's a couple of questions on there. You'll need to know what shifts you right versus left, and also the impacts on percent saturation. You decrease oxygen saturation shifting right. You increase oxygen saturation shifting left. Could you read the chart if given one at this point? Not yet? Okay, let me give you one to try. Let's say that we're at 80 millimeters mercury and we are shifted right because of hot body temperature. Yeah, go to the red line. Yeah, about 90 or so.
Okay, so we're just going to shift right to the right. That means if you say shift right, use the red line.
Yes.
Shift left, use the green line.
Correct. That's
it.
That's right.
Okay.
And the test is copied in black and white, so don't get too hung up on the colors, but yeah, that's right.
It's just left or right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So you said if you decrease oxygen saturation, you shift to the right, and if you increase oxygen saturation, shift to the left.
That's right. That's good. You've now hit the two big topics in this chapter. That's good. What else can I help you with in respiratory? I didn't. Pass it real quick. Okay. If you don't have any other questions, I got a few of these for you to practice on. So let me give you a couple of issues here. Okay, so if someone is exercising and has lactic acidosis, where is the blood pH going?
Down.
Going down. And how do you get rid of all of those hydrogens? Hyperventilate. Good. So the respiration rate should increase. Do we call that hyper or hypoventilation?
Hyper.
Hyper. Good. Is this cause and effect, or is this compensating for a problem?
Compensating.
Yeah, this is a problem that we're compensating for. Good. By the way, the answers are on this in case you want to pull the PowerPoint. Okay.
Okay. So. Okay. I had to.
So if we don't put our blood pH down and we just put acidosis, will that still be
same thing?
Okay.
We're good. Yeah.
Because that's what. Okay.
You know, you can word the number different ways and still be right.
I did practice.
Okay, that's good. Okay, let's try another one. You know, little kids sometimes say they're going to hold their breath until they pass out. Go ahead. Because what's going to happen is the respiration rate will normalize. So let's you read through this one. Okay, so holding your breath has what effect on blood pH? Decrease it, yeah. Making it more acidic, yeah, because you're retaining more. You got it, good. So CO2 levels will increase. That's called
hypercapnia,
right. So notice we're not talking about oxygen here. He doesn't have an oxygen problem. Mm-hmm. He has a pH problem. Mm-hmm. So those pH levels drop, his CO2 levels increase, his respiration rate will
increase.
So even if he passes out first, the medulla and the pons say, start breathing, and the breathing respiration rate kicks back on, and hyperventilation will blow off that excess CO2. Good. Okay. Getting these okay? Okay. All right. Anybody still need the slide? Would you like to try one more? Okay. Okay, here's our next one. pHs and respiration rate will. You got it. Good. So hypoventilate to solve this problem.
So the response would be
the response is a compensation. Yes. Good. Okay, one last one for you here. Ketoacidosis, he may hyperventilate. Why? Get rid of the CO2. What does CO2 have to do with blood pH? Yeah, blood pH decreases with increased CO2. You got it. So that's exactly what's going to happen there. Yeah, blood pH decreases when you've got extra CO2. Just checking, does the sign-in sheet make it around to y'all yet?
No.
It's fine.
Right here.
Okay. I'll wait for it. I'll do one more. Wait for it to get all the way over there, then we'll be done. Oops, that's it. Okay. Anything else I can help you with for Wednesday? If you want to start a few minutes early, I'll come around 12:45 so you can get a head start. So if you're interested, you're welcome to come on early.